No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
Welcome to the Adventure Design Workshop. What we'll do is we'll do introductions first among the three of us up here, and then give a quick rundown of a we got a quick agenda up here. We'll run through. I'll start. My name is Ron Lundin, a fairly new addition to Paizo. I'm a developer for the Adventure Paths.
My name is Linda Zayas Palmer. I am a developer for Organized Play. I work on Pathfinder Society, primarily the role playing guild side, but I'm also working on the Adventure Card Guild now too.
And I'm Michael Sayre. I'm also with the Org Play team, working primarily on Pathfinder Society scenarios.
Okay. We're here to talk about sort of what goes into a good adventure, top elements of adventure design. One of the things that I thought we'd each go through is what we see as the top things that make an adventure great. Maybe we'll reverse the other way and start with Mike.
Right. So I think there are three things that you really have to have in an adventure for it to be good. And one of the things is surprise. There has to be something that the party didn't see coming, that the players didn't know was going to happen, because that will really kind of open it up and it will help it stick in their memories. The other thing that helps people remember it is there has to be an iconic element. The adventures that people really remember have something that was really unique to that adventure that they didn't see somewhere else, or that they've only seen like once before in some random book or story. And then once you've got like those elements in there, the things that are going to hook the player, that are going to make them remember the adventure that they participated in, the other thing that you have to have is versatility within the adventure itself. People have to be able to find their own way to the end. The more they feel like the adventure forced them to a conclusion, the less they're going to like it, the less fun it's going to be. They need to be able to navigate it at their own pace and in their own way to really understand it. And when you take that along with those elements of surprise and that whatever that iconic twist that you throw in there is, that's what's going to make an adventure that people are going to enjoy, that they're going to love, and that they're going to remember.
You know, it's funny because I was thinking, I literally was thinking surprise and having things, and basically surprise and versatility, those exact two things. And it's like, oh, yeah, that was what I was going to say. But yeah, it's important that that there are multiple ways to approach the encounter. And when you have I guess we're going to get to this a bit later, but when you have like a published adventure, that the adventure responds to choice, that when the NPCs can react to the way that the PCs interact with them, and when you can allow the players to personalize the story. So I also like adventures that, when adventures can have connections and they can evolve based on the PCs' actions. So if you have an adventure that might go in a different way, okay, you know, this NPC remembers you, they're going to come back later, and they may be a friend or they may be a foe based on how you handle it. So making the PCs feel that their actions, that their decisions, that they matter and they have long-term consequences for the world and for how people are going to relate to them and what their future is going to be, that they're telling their own story.
And then I think the number one thing that I'd add, I think all those are great, and now I regret going last, but but the number one thing that I'd add is a memorable antagonist. I almost thought memorable villain, but then I realized there are some great adventures that don't have a monolithic evil or a single entity as a villain, but are still great adventures. But they have some sort of antagonist, some sort of conflict. Could be a forest fire, right, that is somehow involved, mm-hmm. That the PCs are trying to strive against. It has to feel like it's got some real weight and some real stake, although weight and stake varies a lot based on the character's level and their abilities and so on. You know, what could be something that is a memorable antagonist, you know, a were-rat running a thieves' guild at low levels, wouldn't make for a good, memorable antagonist for a bunch of 17th level characters, for example. So those are some of the points that we had. One of the things that I thought would be a good question to ask is talk about home game adventures versus published adventures. I want to get a sense of this from the room. How many of you principally use, either as GM or player, published adventures in what you do? Pathfinder Society or the published stuff that we do? How many principally use just home games sort of invented on your own sort of adventures. I think there's a substantial majority here that says that the home game is what it is they do. Sort of adventures that are on the fly or that have the personal connection that the created with the personal connection that the GM can make with the players. What would you say are the primary differences between those? Linda?
Yes. So I would say that when you have a published adventure, the published adventure by its nature is going to have less ability to dynamically respond to what the PCs do. But in a way it makes you kind of like playing this what-if game with yourself. When you look at this encounter, how might the PCs respond? So when I'm working on adventures, I like to draw diagrams where I write, okay, you know, the PCs encounter this band of raiders. Do they decide to attack them? Okay, what happens if they succeed? What happens if they fail? Do they decide to talk to them? What happens if they succeed? What happens if they fail? To try to make sure that you don't get stuck. Because I think that's one of the main things is that, you know, you want people to... It's good when the adventure can respond to the PCs, and particularly with organized play, and you don't have the GM getting stuck saying, well, you went way off here, and that's not in the adventure, and how am I going to get you back on to what you were saying? I actually did have one other thing to say for the top elements of a great adventure, that I like to see variety in the challenge and the pacing. Because sometimes PCs want to, you know, they're going to want to steamroll over things. They're going to want to feel awesome. Like, they're going to want to feel that they got stronger. And sometimes they're going to want a challenge. And if you have, you know, too many of one or the other, then it either feels like, oh, we're about to die all the time. Or, oh, well, I guess we'll fight this thing. But you don't get the excitement there. And I think that the pacing really is gonna depend from group to group. In organized play, we sort of have some standards of that, of like, okay, you know, in the higher level scenarios for the higher level characters, we're gonna bring that challenge level up higher because we know they're gonna have more to be able to deal with, that they're gonna have more flexibility. But then for those low level adventures, we know that you're gonna have less flexibility, you're more likely to have new players who are still figuring out their characters, maybe still figuring out the system. So then we still look at that arc where you have, you know, some easier encounters to figure things out, then you might go up to a harder one, then you might, if you've got a longer adventure, then you might have some time to rest after that and recuperate and show your skill. But then for the lower levels, we just have like kind of the smaller bumps and rises. And we also like to, in some of our scenarios, we like to give choice for how difficult the scenario is. Like, some of our adventures have hard modes that you can go in, and if the table all has buy-in and they say, well, we want to fight the harder version of this, then you can do that. So that's another thing you can do for difficulty customization.
One of the things I really like is I found that more and more some of the best adventures I have is when I take a published adventure and then have the time to put like the homebrew spin on it. Because the cool thing about published adventures that they really do is you have to be a good GM before... Well, I guess you don't have to be a good GM before you get an adventure published, but odds are pretty good that if you've gotten to the point where you've gotten an adventure published, that you're a good GM, which means you've learned things from the people that you've GM'd for, the people that you've run adventures for, and those things get translated on the page when you write an adventure. So as a GM myself, every time I open up one of those published adventures, it's really exciting for me because I'm learning something about the person who wrote it, what they expected from their players, how they thought the game was going to go, and it broadens my own knowledge. And then I immediately probably start chopping it up and eviscerating it and changing things out because I know what my players are going to do, and I'm like, Isaac's not going to fall for that. Nope. You know? But that's really like, there's strengths to both of those. The published adventure is someone putting all of their knowledge and skill into the like best form that they can create for it. And then as a GM, you get to learn from that. And then you get to take the best pieces of it and add it to your own adventure design as it broadens your own toolbox. So I would definitely say if you've never used a published adventure, do it just for the learning experience. Do it just to see what happens when somebody else thought that this was the way something was going to go. And you'll grow just from that alone.
I think the biggest difference between the two is the knowledge about the PC capabilities. Yeah. When we're doing a published adventure, we've got some benchmarks we know. If it's for PCs that are fifth level or higher, they have some ability to fly. If it's for ninth level or higher, they have some ability to teleport. and almost certainly some ability to come back from the dead if need be. That might not be the case for your individual group. And so if you've got high-level adventurers who aren't able to fly, then the sort of foes you put them up against might be different, or the sort of things that you structure, the sort of obstacles you have, can be different because you know them better. And if you've pulled a published adventure for 11th level characters that assume they can all fly up a thing, and you know your PCs can't, right? That's you've got the better knowledge if you're running a home game adventure. So the difference between PC capabilities. I thought Mike said what you said about getting a published adventure in order to learn is fantastic, because there is I don't think there's a good GM. I don't think there's a great GM that wasn't at one time a terrible GM. Frankly, I mean I think back with horror about some of the initial, you know, Journey to the Rock and the thing that I tried to run. Anyway, a good published adventure helps all kinds of GMs. It gives great GMs a lot of room to be awesome and sort of expand or contract or cut up, as you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. It gives average GMs sort of the ability to sort of hone their craft, sort of see, you feel confident that even if their players go off the rails, the adventure's got some structure to bring them back to it. And then frankly, it's got something even for poor GMs that want to improve by seeing how these sort of things are sort of structured for, you know, in a professional product. Oh, I see they don't actually put 15 encounters all back to back with no ability to rest, right? That's so there's some advantages that that has.
It's a much more approachable way to get started. Yeah. I know when my friends were asking me to GM for them, I was thinking, oh, well, I haven't done this before. I don't know. I don't know if I can do this. And then I picked up Council of Thieves, and I ran that. And that was where I got started with GMing. And then I got into Pathfinder Society scenarios. And it was just a really nice way to learn the game and then to learn to GM. And then the more I GM, the more I felt comfortable saying, okay, you know, well, maybe I'm using an adventure path, but maybe we're going to run this for 9 months on this side adventure that I came up with, and then we're going to stick in this module from this third party, and then we're going to go back to the adventure path, and we're going to go on slow track, and I may need to modify it because slow track isn't slow enough for how much we're doing in this adventure. But it's a really good starting point as well.
It reminds me of a conversation I had with one of our designers, Logan Bonner, where we were talking about the flavor text that goes into an adventure. You know, when you have a room, there's always a little bit of box text that talks about, you know, some description of the room. And we had the conversation about how a really good GM probably won't use that, because he's going to have read the adventure, he's going to have absorbed it, and he's going to, you know, relay it in his own voice, or her own voice, as the case may be. But you don't start out knowing how to say that stuff. And so that box text, a good GM doesn't need it, but it's going to teach a learning GM how to present that information, how to say those things. And it's going to help them find their voice so that they can move on and then really learn to make those things their own and then move into broader homebrew worlds and things like that.
I think that Logan would take all box text and put it on a big fire and burn it all.
Yes, he would.
I think he would.
All right. One of the other things I wanted to point out here, some of the pitfalls in adventures. What with so many people doing home adventures, it's probably everybody's got some story probably about the when things just didn't work. Some of the things that that we've got in our experience. In my experience, an adventure can come to a grinding halt with what I've heard called a skill wall, where somebody has to succeed at some check for the adventure to continue. You know, everybody has to succeed at this perception. Somebody has to succeed at this DC 20 perception check, or they just don't find the next clue to go on. Not great adventure design. Anytime you've got a required skill check to succeed, to proceed, you have to have at least another couple of ways around it. Now, even the shorthand, and I don't love it, even the shorthand of have all the PCs make perception checks, the one that rolls the highest gets. I mean, that's at least a way to try to get over a skill wall. There are also skill failure walls. I had a home game GM one time who was otherwise great, but in one scene where we had to get, where it was the villain needed to know where we were as we were traversing through this forest, it was a series of stealth checks until we failed them, right? And the fact we happened to all be really good at stealth meant it was an awful lot of, I succeed, keep rolling, I succeed. I'm like, really? Really? You know, this is not, This is the it's the inverse of a skill ditch, I guess maybe I call it. I'm now creating that term. But that's one of the big pitfalls that I see, skill walls, skill ditches.
To generalize that a bit, I think that any time you have an adventure that has a choke point that assumes that the PCs are going to succeed at a particular check, or they're going to like this NPC that you put in there, and they're going to make friends with that NPC, and then they're going to listen to what that NPC says and go on the mission, then you have a place where you can really fall off, because then it's like, well, what if they don't do that? Then what? And you need to find some other way to either go around and get them back on track, or either that, or realize your players don't want to do what you've set up, and you know, work with them to figure out what they actually do want to do.
Yeah. I think we've got a lot of homebrewers in the room. So one of the things I'm saying is, like, I think every GM has at least one really good story in their heart that they want to tell. And that's why they want to be a GM, is because they're somewhere inside of there is a storyteller with a story to tell. But that can also be a real pitfall of running a game, because it's not just your story. Every person at the table is having a hand in that story. And your players are going to figure out really fast if they don't actually have any agency in the story. If they're just there doing things, and what's going to happen was always going to happen because that's the story that you wanted to tell, you're going to lose your players' interest. They're going to start pulling out the iPads. They're going to start checking out. Somebody's going to have, you know, work next week and not be able to make it. Then they're going to have a play date for their dog and not be able to make it. In the end, it's going to spiral real quick because they're going to lose that investment. When you have an adventure, there is, I mean, really nothing more important than getting your players invested, whatever that means. And you're going to know that better than anybody else, or hopefully you'll know that better than anybody else. And if you don't know that and you find that your players aren't invested, I would say the number one piece of advice that seems really obvious but that people miss a lot of the time is ask your players what they want. Ask them what they sat down at the table looking for, and then try to find a way to fulfill your desire to tell a story with their desire to interact with the story in a particular way.
And one way to go about that and make sure that you don't have a one solution problem is, whenever you present a problem, see if you can envision several different ways the PCs might go about it, several different approaches they might take. Because then if you set up a situation like that, then you know that you haven't just created one path. I was going to say something else, but I forgot.
Well, I will just barge in. I've been accused of being boorish, bordering on tactless for some time, despite my wife's best efforts to make me civilized. But to follow up on your point, I think that most groups don't have enough of the conversation around, are we all getting something we like out of this? And if not, how do we pivot to that? I just recently had a group I was with sort of be, you know, they had sort of some back chatter among them about who's going to come to me to say, this isn't the kind of game that we want to play. Could we pivot this to a different kind of game? And I was a little bit frustrated, not that they ultimately came to me, but they didn't, that I hadn't thought to ask that question first, right? Is this, you know, is this grueling series of adventures something everybody's having fun with? Turns out the answer was no, not so much. We'd like something a little more lighthearted. So that kind of communication I think is really important. And adventures are a good way to sort of crystallize the elements around it.
Yeah. So for that, there's the session zero in the beginning, talking to all the players about what they want, talking to the players about what they want for their character, you know, if they want to be engaged in the story in a certain way, and working with them to make those sorts of hooks. And then there's also checking in regularly along the way, particularly if you notice someone who is getting on their phone or someone who isn't around as much, just to make sure that, you know, everyone's having a good time.
One of the cool things you'll discover is that as you get to know your players and you get more experienced at crafting adventures and stuff, is a lot of times the things they want will tell you what kind of elements you actually want to weave into your story to give everybody what they're looking for. Like, I remember I really wanted to run an intrigue adventure one time, but like every one of my players was like, I don't want to do social stuff. I want to go dungeon crawl, smash kobolds, you know, the classic stuff. And so I had already kind of written up an initial adventure in the city, and I just immediately pivoted down into these sewers beneath the city. And at some point in time, as I was just kind of moving towards what I wanted and reacting to what they wanted and making sure everybody was happy, suddenly there was like this massive political coup amongst the kobold tribes who lived in the sewers, and I actually got the intrigue adventure I wanted in a way that I had completely not expected. So
it was feeding into what they wanted.
Exactly.
As well,
so. Yes.
All right. We have the word workshop in the title, so let's all of us make an adventure together. It's going to have a bunch of we're going to need a bunch of different components. I want to go with what you said, Mike. First, I want to say, okay, so we're going to put together an adventure before we talk about sort of what, you know, it's going to be, sort of villains or minions or challenge rating or, you know, what's going to be going on there. I want the iconic element really struck with me. We're going to put an adventure together. What's going to be the iconic element of our adventure? What's the event, the location, the something that the PCs are going to be. Yeah, that really connects me.
Anybody?
Iconic elements from the group.
Yes.
Heist of a castle.
Alrighty.
There we go.
Yeah,
heist of a castle.
Remember that. So we're going to have our castle heist adventure. Alrighty, sounds good. Hoots. Mm-hmm. Who's our principal antagonist in the Heist of a Castle adventure? Maybe the antagonist might be trying to pull off the heist itself, but there'd be a captain of the guard, maybe?
Prince was displaced, and he's trying to take it back. Because that's, I mean, like, he rallied an army and or a group of adventurers and is trying to take the castle back, so it's taking the castle as a heist.
Okay. So displaced, what'd you say, displaced?
A displaced prince is trying to take back the castle.
Okay.
And has an army?
And has an army. Of what? Who knows? Awful things, probably. Awful things.
And the prince is a mind flayer, too.
Already. Well, we would, for reasons of intellectual property. We have a... What are we doing today? So other than something similarly monstrous, but let's just say we couldn't use Mind Flayer for whatever reason.
From antagonist to the shape changer. Who's posing as the either a prince or the chamberlain.
Alrighty. He is some sort of horrible shape changer.
I'm already, like, spinning this in my head. I'm like, no, okay, I got it. So the real prince is dead. He's been replaced by a doppelganger.
It's a workshop.
The doppelganger needs to go steal it, right? Like, no, are we there?
All righty. This displaced prince, is that... I don't know. Is the displaced prince... Are our heroes working for the displaced prince, or are they...
I think the heroes are working for the prince, because the prince was, like, the antagonist would be whoever took the castle.
Got it. The shape changer is taken over, and the prince is saying, hey, I need your help. I want to get my castle back. You need to steal it back for me. All righty. We're starting to see a thread here. What? When we start thinking more specifically about challenges, mm-hmm. What level are our PCs?
Five?
No, high.
High? High.
15?
15th? Maybe 15th level? Alrighty.
Well, I wonder what's in that army then, if we got 15th level PCs.
I wonder what's in the castle. Alrighty, so high level PCs. High
that level begs the question, where's the castle?
In hell.
I like
in
it.
In hell.
The castle's
right.
In hell.
And what kind of wards would a castle in hell have to protect against an invasion? Holy water?
You're working for... Is the best one? I think you're literally trying to steal the castle back from hell to get it back to where it's supposed to be.
You're heisting.
The heist is not... It's not a castle heist. It is a heist of a castle.
The castle heist is the actual castle itself.
It's like you're trying to take over the castle, but it's actually... You're literally trying to steal the castle back.
Literally trying to steal the castle back.
So is the castle from hell and now is the castle from hell and elsewhere, or is the castle taken to hell in there? Okay.
No, I'm seeing a lot of no.
Okay, no. The castle's in hell.
Alright. Is the castle from heaven? It's some sort of celestial castle and the displaced prince. Is this had it stolen away?
No.
Boo.
Where's it
yes,
from?
Yes, boo, 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 they say. Where's it from?
The previous king.
It's made out of ice.
So the previous king had a contract, and that's why it's in hell, and the castle is made out of ice, and so it might melt if you leave it there too long.
It depends on where in hell it goes, I suppose.
Well, now we know it's in a hot place in hell.
Fair enough.
What if the prince was some sort of a devil who was summoned and then bound in the material realm or whatever, and then they took the castle while he was gone, and now he's hired a group of adventurers to...
So the prince himself is a devil who has been bound in the material world for some period of time.
Like a high-level cleric or something. And now he's free, but he's got to get his castle back.
He's no longer bound, but the castle went to hell, and he's not particularly interested in being in hell with the castle at this point.
Because it won't be there for much longer.
All right. So we've got a literal castle heist with a displaced devil prince who has hired the heroes, who are all very high level, to go to hell and steal his ice castle back before it melts. You know, it's funny, for a moment there I was worried this was going to go way off the rails, but now I'm feeling very comfortable.
We're okay, but we've got a shape changer that took it.
So that's a good question. So the shape changer was the one who took the castle, or because I was under the impression initially that it was our prince who was a shape changer. Poll the audience. Where is our shape changer? Is he the one who stole the castle, or is that our prince? Because do the heroes? Here's the one. Do the heroes know that they are working for a devil?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Who says yes?
Show of
yes,
hands.
They know it's a devil. Oh, very few. Who says no? Oops. There's the surprise, by Quaddy. There we go.
Heroes don't know.
All right. And it certainly could be. I want to throw in a third option for the shape changer. We're sort of concepting an adventure, you know. Is it this print? Did he steal? Is this shape changer? Did take the castle or not? Or do we want to jettison the shape changer idea entirely? Yeah, you know, a lot of things kind of come and go. Okay, who says the shape changer is in fact the antagonist? We're going to work it in. Okay, shape changer is allied. I think that was the second one. Jettison shape changer. Who's a jettison shape changer? I think we have more jettison shape changers. Okay, there's no shape changer anymore.
Shape changer's gone. So, heist of a castle, displaced devil prince, heroes don't know, in hell, stealing back our ice castle before it melts. So I think one of the things that we need right now is we need an engine that is keeping the castle going. Either the castle itself is made out of some type of special ice, or there is something in the castle that allows the ice to exist for some period of time long enough for this adventure to occur.
Elsa from Frozen.
I'm pretty sure that if we tried to work Elsa from Frozen into an adventure, the issues would start with a lawsuit and end with, at the very least, the adventure not getting published or someone not having a job. So. So he's like an ice devil. He's like a Gelligon or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he said it's tied to the soul of a devil?
Yes. The longer he stays on the material plane, the weaker he gets, and the castle starts to melt.
And the longer he stays on the material plane, the weaker he gets, and the castle starts to melt. You got that, Mike?
I got it.
Good.
All right. All right, so we need to have this castle filled with awesomeness, or else the PCs are just going to go in and see the... I mean, what's in the castle now?
White dragon.
Did I hear hydras?
I heard white dragon.
White dragon?
Okay, better.
And I imagine in addition to creatures that a devil's castle is probably filled with all sorts of devious tricks and traps. What sort of things like that might you expect in there? Yeah?
Future versions of the player characters themselves who have been corrupted.
Corrupted versions of the PCs.
So higher level versions of the PCs that have been corrupted.
Corrupted by the devil? That'd be wild.
Or the magic of the castle itself.
Oh, I like this. I like this for the reveal part, because the PCs... The surprise happens later. So the PCs see corrupted versions of themselves... How on earth? What on earth would make us work for a devil? And then later, surprise! The prince you've been working for is in fact a devil.
this explains why he wanted us to sign a contract about rescuing the castle.
You read the fine print, right?
Blah, 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 payment in gold, blah, 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 payment in magic items, blah, 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 soul.
Whatever.
TLDR, sure, whatever.
Alrighty, so we got White Dragon. Duplicate, yeah, corrupted duplicates of the PCs. None of those sound like good minions. I think that a lot of good adventures have hewing through minions. 15th level PCs, they can be pretty tough minions, but there's got to be a lot of them.
Unfrozen cavemen. The more come out, the more it melts.
What's that?
Unfrozen cavemen.
Unfrozen cavemen. You know, though, there is actually a really good element to that, because maybe the concern about the castle melting and the reason, right? So, like, devils love souls, right? Maybe this castle is built out of this entire civilization of an ancient species, and all of the blocks contain a soul of a person who's been, yeah, we're liking this, okay, we're getting somewhere, of someone who's made a deal with this devil and been trapped. So this is literally all of the blocks of ice that form the castle. Each block of ice is a soul, and the reason the devil wants the castle back is because if it melts, he doesn't only lose his castle, he loses all of the souls that he's accumulated over his eons of existence.
So why is his, how did his castle get onto hell anyway?
Maybe it was always there.
Yeah. Rival devil? Maybe it was always there?
Did the white dragon take it?
Did the white dragon take it?
Fiendish white dragon sounds like the name.
Fiendish white dragon.
So he captured the souls as they melt, as they were released.
Sorry, could you say it again?
Another devil has taken it so that as the castle melts, it can capture the souls to add to his own power.
Another devil has taken it so that he can capture the released souls as they escape.
It's a soul heist.
A soul heist. Our castle heist has turned into a soul heist. It can be both, though. It is like a soul castle soul heist now. That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
So the idea that the hopeful goal of this adventure is that the PCs will have the opportunity to free those souls. Probably something that they will discover is a goal of this adventure right around the time they see the corrupted versions of themselves in the castle.
And I like that too, because it gives them a choice of how they want to go. You know, they go like, you know, are they going to continue working for this devil? Is that all right by them? Because they're going to get whatever they got from the contract, or are they going to say, well, no, we're going to save these souls?
All right.
So that's a piece, that's a PC actions matter,
yes,
piece. That was your point, actually.
Yes.
The PC actions have to matter, particularly this end.
And I imagine it would be more challenging to rescue those souls than it would be to just say, okay, contract done, we're out of here, we got what we were looking for.
You can have your castle, your ice castle. Now you've got your ice castle back, filled with the souls we know are in it. Mm-hmm. And we know that you have not hesitated to stoop to putting corrupted versions of ourselves out there. So, if not directly, that you know, dealing with corrupted versions of ourselves. So we're not going to leave you with the souls. We're going to fight back in order to see that they're free. They go to the rightful place.
As a note to all the GMs out there, be aware. Probably at least 25% of you are going to have a group of players who see the corrupted versions of themselves and are like, we are on the right track, guys.
See player choices.
Yep. Okay, so we've got a pretty good structure here. My question is, how then do we break this out into without going encounter by encounter? How do we break out the flow of this adventure that is going to... We know from our very high level the stuff that's going on in this adventure, but when you break out an adventure into its component parts, its component chapters, you've got to know, walk it through from the player's perspective, right? They don't know initially. So the players, the first chapter, right?
Yep.
I think the players get approached by the prince they do not know is a devil.
Yeah, point of contact.
And who offers to send them to hell, explain the situation, so my ice castle has been taken, please go get it back, send them to hell. So that's the initial, and then maybe some initial, you know, finding it within hell or something like that.
And now they're 15th level PCs, and 15th level PCs have a lot of shenanigans going on. How is the devil going to make sure the PCs don't find out he's a devil right from the get-go?
Man, that's a good question.
I think he's got to work through an intermediary. Otherwise, somebody's going to be like, oh, detect, or some.
He's working through an intermediary?
Yeah.
Either that or he's an archdevil?
He's got some sort of artifact that can, like, hide his alignment and true identity.
He's got an artifact, or he's got access to spells or something that allow him to conceal his identity. I like that, because if this guy's been around for a long time, and especially if he's got a castle full of souls, I assume at some point he decided he wanted a new wing on that thing, and so he's probably had to fool people a few times in his long career. So it's either his innate magic through something like being a sorcerer, or it is some sort of artifact or item that he has that allows him to conceal his true nature.
What if he's a summoner and his Eidolon is like a human wizard?
A reverse summoner?
Switch it around. So he's got some sort of cat's paw he uses to be...
How most people play the summoners? They're like, I want to be the big monster that has a little guy who's kind of my pet that heals
me.
I'm going to be a gnome. I'm just going to go in a pouch that's around my Eidolon's neck and just ride around there. You won't see me, or I'll cast invisibility and hide in the back.
Okay. But we know that that's got to be something that we think about when we put this together.
Yep. Okay.
Whether we're thinking about it from a sort of published adventure perspective, where you actually sort of build in some likely ways the 15th level PCs could uncover the shenanigans, or perhaps more effectively in a home game, you know exactly the sorts of shenanigans your PCs are capable of. With their 15th level players, they're the same ones they were using at 14th level and 13th level, except a little better. So we've got them. So we get them
to hell.
Accept the mission,
yep.
To hell, standing in front of the ice castle. And then we have the chapter two, which is
infiltrate
the ice castle.
Because are they standing in front of the ice castle? We had to mention that there was an army involved in this at one point, and maybe we've moved away from that, but let's not throw it out immediately, right? He's a devil. He's been around for a long time. He's got a castle full of souls, so maybe the heroes are doing something and the army is just his distraction to create an opportunity, or do we have another good idea out there? He's got multiple white dragons that are keeping the castle frozen, and so if they are killed, then it actually speeds up the process of the castle melting. That's actually like a really cool idea, though, because for the people in the castle, it looks like they're being attacked by dragons, but for the guy attacking the castle, he's like, just focus on the walls.
And the PCs are like, we're adventurers, killing dragons is our job, but killing dragons is bad.
and I like that too, because whenever you have those opportunities where if the PCs figure something out, they've got the high knowledge skills, or they just kind of figure something out themselves, and then they can come up with a clever solution. They might realize, oh, you know what, if we sneak past these dragons instead of killing them, then things will be easy for us later on. So the different approaches have different consequences and different ways that the story evolves.
I like that, but we want to make sure that the PCs, they can screw everything up. They can miss any kind of clue.
Yeah.
They fail their knowledge checks, let's have some sort of potentially helpful NPC that can also give them that knowledge if they don't get it themselves. Somebody who's in the castle who kind of knows at least a little bit about what's going on, possibly helpful to the PCs.
One of the released souls.
I think the castle's probably going to be full of imps that don't really know that a demon has even changed hands of the castle. Like, they're imps completely brainless, just doing their daily chores. So they could either help you or not help you.
The castle is full of imp servitors who maybe just kind of work for whoever is running the castle at the moment.
Maybe a relic that is tapping in the plane of ice?
A relic in the ice?
No, tapping in the plane of ice. That he may be having or draining power from the plane of ice to fuel the castle or something like that.
We've got a relic or something in the castle that is tied to the plane of ice, and it's pulling it through. Actually, that's kind of a really interesting idea for a quote-unquote helpful NPC. If there's, like, a massive ice golem or an ice elemental who is just kind of, like, the engine of this thing.
Or that came through from some sort of planar connection. I see some sort of, you know, wise ancient ice elemental. What's all this that... Oh, my goodness! And sees the PCs as the people that might be able to sort of fix it. So the PCs need to know... The only thing this figure knows is what has to do with the ice of the castle. Doesn't necessarily know the devil politics around that. That's up for the PCs to figure out. But knowing that, what we are getting back to, that the white dragons are actually keeping it cold and this is what happens when they do and why, this ice elemental figure, the wizened wise ice elemental figure knows that.
I wonder if you can convince the ice elemental to help you.
Maybe he's enslaved.
Well, the ice elemental is a simulacrum of prince, since a simulacrum has to be made.
Oh, just made of snow! So you get to see another prince there.
Made
it's sort of like a snow version of the prince.
Mm-hmm.
Who does not, we previously established, break into song at any point.
Just to be clear.
And is tied as the engine.
What if the players, when they first meet their, like, shadow selves, meet them in, they walk in the room, they find an ice dragon and themselves fighting this ice dragon. And they end up defeating it because they think they're helping themselves, and that's when they realize that defeating the ice dragon is actually a bad thing and it hurts them, and they end up having to fight themselves or something like that.
The players encounter the corrupted versions of themselves battling
them the bad version and then realize they did a bad thing on accident because they thought they were helping.
So they initially see themselves fighting something. They try to assist themselves. See, here's actually a potential pitfall of the adventure, right? Because some of the adventurers are going to be like, oh no, we're in danger? Still probably best to help them. Other people are going to be like, there can be only one! And it's not going to go the way you think.
Often within the same party.
Yeah.
They kill themselves and the dragon thanks them.
It is a point where you have some flexibility to go a couple different ways. Because you could also look at that as if we've got a simulacrum and we've got more than one force active inside of the castle, then the PCs taking either side could earn them the ally
that they need. I like that. Yep. It gives them the knowledge and lets them go. But in any case, the chapter two of the adventure is inside the castle itself.
Yes.
The PCs, by making some ally or another, and that I really like the opportunity that they can go either way, and have a couple different routes to learn it, figure out what's going on in the castle, and then understand that the nature of the soul-trapping ice is the clock they're up against, and it's what they need to use or do to get the to heist the castle back with its souls.
Mm-hmm.
So then they do it. Chapter 2. Chapter 3 is the conclusion. They're going to be facing their... It can't be as straightforward as they bring the castle back and then their former patron. Ha-ha! I mean, what wrinkle do we throw in here?
Maybe they have to defeat the devil that stole the castle, and it was a love interest of the devil you contracted with, and things got too steamy.
So maybe the devil who stole the castle was a former love interest of the devil that they are working for, and things got a little too steamy, so they took off with the castle. Yes. That's it. Well, so then you can have some fun dichotomy. That can be the kind of thing that can make the adventure pop, is like, why was this ice devil running around with this being of pure flame? Maybe that worked for a while for some reason. Opposites attract.
Also, you deal with the element difference, too, because if they're prepared for a bunch of ice and now all of a sudden they're fighting fire, they're not prepared for that.
If they're then running around in the ice, they're not prepared for fighting ice dragons.
Yeah. Encounter variety is good too, because that way, you know, you can provide more challenges and also make sure that you don't have a certain PCs who feel like they're shut out and can't contribute in certain ways.
Yeah.
I often use a catchy title or something as a thing that helps keep me centered on the idea. And in this discussion, I am wondering if I would have named this adventure Better the Devil You Know and used that as kind of an inspiration, because I would love to have an adventure called
A catchy title, like Better the Devil You Know.
Better the Devil You Know.
Yes.
I don't know. That may even be better than Castle Heist.
I assumed in Castle Heist, it was like H-I-C-E-T.
Back here.
What if the entire adventure was a ruse and the person that stole it was actually him? And these adventurers are basically cultivated to become, like, not the corrupted person, but like stronger souls that will make the castle even stronger.
So the question was, what if he stole the castle from himself and the PCs were essentially the real target the whole time? And that would actually explain why there is a corrupted version of the PCs in there in the first place. If they're high-level PCs, if we're talking 15th level people who can go to hell and stuff like that, then not only is there a possibility that they have made a lot of enemies in the things that they have done up to this point, but there is also the possibility that they themselves are of significant value to people who know how to utilize them. So that's actually a pretty clever idea.
And that could also give the PCs more of a reason to go after the devil in the end, too, if they discover that they were being used the whole time. I mean, PCs don't like being used.
I like that. Because what we have in the chapter 3 in the climactic encounter with their former patron is not, we've done your job, oh wait, you're evil. It's over the course of chapter 2, they've learned exactly what's going on, and they actually bring the castle back with all their buff spells up, armed to the teeth for that final conflict, because they know that they've been sort of screwed over by their patron right from the while they've been going through.
Well, if they were legitimately contracted to go rescue this castle, then completing the contract could be what seals the deal, and now you have completed a contract and deal with the devil, and your souls are up for grabs. That's the kind of thing. Making deals with devils very rarely ends well for the people who do it, even if they didn't know that's what they were doing at the time. So there's a lot of good potential there.
Okay, but it does bring us to, and we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to say that does bring us to the dramatic conclusion of the adventure that we have. One thing that I'd like to make sure, apart from the fact that they're able to sort of, you know, if I find a dragon horde in here and maybe ice theme sort of stuff, what are the PCs at the end of, what do they get out of it that feels like a good reward for them based on what they've done up in the adventure till just now? I mean, apart from being 16th level, right? I mean, there's what's going to be some sort of outcome, treasure, sort of, you know, maybe some sort of aspect that the PCs earn from this that makes it feel like a really good.
The civilization that was trapped as souls inside the castle being released, they can now rebuild that civilization and be an ally to the heroes.
I like that. We're at the level now where PCs want to be seen as like a whole patron of. You know, saved people.
So the feedback was that the civilization trapped within the ice, for anybody who is listening to this on Twitch, that freeing them from the castle makes that civilization open to being allies of the PCs in some way, shape, or form.
Flourishing.
Or they just keep the castle.
Or they just keep the castle.
I like that. This is my castle, man.
Maybe they delve deep enough, they figure out how the castle got transported to hell in the first place. They figure out how to destroy it, and it lets them free back to the material realm.
Just the act of returning the castle to the material realm, or destroying the castle is what returns the souls to the material realm, something like that. Okay.
Ooh, we're home game people. So we know what's going on in the future of our campaign pretty quick. It's not a past villain that set them up. It's somebody in the future that they'd learn something about or something to... they are somehow exposed because of this.
I like it as a pivot point, because we've been talking about the fact that there is some percentage of the adventurers playing this who are going to be like really on board with devil powers and making this thing happen. So I like that there's two possible ways to go. You know, is there the like serve towards heaven or rule in hell angle at the end of this?
Alrighty. But that gets us to the end of our adventure as well as the end of our time. And so I think we can we can probably safely announce, you know, Paizo's next quarter publication, Better the Devil You Know or Castle Heist. Coming soon. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.